The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Some content in this video is not covered under our Creative Commons license. See the closing credits for more information.
Started. Today we have a guest lecture for you, Jenna Hofstein from, is your company called Monster & Glitch?
Little Worlds Interactive.
Little Worlds Interactive.
New company, new name.
New company, new name. Cool. From Little Worlds Interactive, we'll be talking to us about usability. Today the things you're supposed to have turned in by now, your product backlog, your upcoming task list for your next sprint. If you have a design guide or a design document, turn that in. I believe that was it. After the lecture, we're going to have each of the teams give between 2 to 5 minutes of presentation about just where you are, some informal talk about where you are in the project right now. If you have your product backlog and can display it on the screen, please do.
But otherwise, no slides.
But otherwise, no slides needed. And then after that, if we have prototypes in class, I think we're supposed to have a prototype ready to go if you didn't do a design guide. We'll have open testing available for prototypes. And we'll also talk a little bit about product backlog if you have any questions about where do you go for a large project, what your backlog is looking right now. That about covers it. So, I'm going to have Jenna take it away.
Hi, my name is Jenna Hofstein. I have a cold, so if I sniffle my way through this presentation, please forgive me. I'm going to try not to cough everywhere. So I'm here today to talk a little bit about usability. Please feel free to ask questions at any point during the presentation. I get really excited talking about this stuff, so I'm just going to go and talk about all the usability things. But if you have a question or a concern, or you're just like, I have no idea what the hell is going on, please feel free to just raise your hand at any point. So first, let me give you a really brief overview of who I am. I've been in the games industry for about 6 or 7 years at this point. I've worked at a number of local companies, including Turbine, Hangout, Stomp Games. And I've worked on everything from MMOs to Facebook games all the way down to mobile games. Right now, I recently founded my own studio, Little Worlds Interactive, and I'm making educational games for kids, not like the crap that you see on the App Store nowadays, but good stuff that harkens back to like Oregon Trail and Carmen Sandiego. So that's what I'm working on. I've spent a lot of time getting involved in playtests, and I really enjoy trying to get into the mind of the player. So I've picked up a lot about usability throughout sort of all the jobs that I've had. And I wouldn't consider myself an expert, but I want to share a little bit about what I've learned with you today. So I want to start by talking about how I got interested in usability. At my first job out of college, I got nominated as the web designer, not because I had any qualifications whatsoever, but I was sort of the least unqualified. It was a really small company, so it was like, whew, Jenna, web design, nice thing to add to your resume. So I had to create a splash page that had some way for the player to sign up. So I put, quite literally, a big red button in the middle of the page that said join now. And I was like, mission accomplished. I didn't know it beforehand, but I'm amazing at web design. Nobody's going to be able to miss this button. It's going to be great. So I sat down with the first play tester, and I was like, all right, go ahead and sign up, make an account. And they looked at the page, and they looked at the page, and they kind of got that squinty look, and they were like, and I'm sitting there having a panic attack because I'm like, are we both in the same reality right now? There's a really big button in the middle of the page that says join now. What the hell is going on? And so this happened multiple times with multiple different play testers, and I kept asking them, what are you looking for? What are you doing? And every time they said, I'm trying to figure out how to sign up. And I finally figured out they were literally scanning the page for the word sign up. So because I had the words join now on my button, they would see it, like their eyes literally go over it, but they wouldn't perceive it. Their brain would go, oh, that's irrelevant, and move on to the next thing. So this is my first really big lesson in usability. It's so much harder than it looks, but it's what kind of set me down this path. So today I'm not going to teach you everything about usability because we'd be here for at least a couple of years, but I tried to kind of cherry pick a few really interesting things in the hopes that it would inspire you to go home and learn some more. Okay. So what is usability? Basically, it's how easy is your game to use, and how learnable is your game. It's those two simple things. So when we're talking about learnability, it's basically how good is your tutorial. When we're talking about efficiency, once I've learned how to do something in your game, how easy is it for me to do that? So if you have a very basic action in your game that is buried in 17 submenus, you have a problem. Memorability, when I put your game down for 3 months and then come back to it, how easy is it for me to pick back up? Errors, this is stuff like how many errors do players make and how easy is it for them to recover from those errors? So if you have a side-scrolling platformer and if the player hits the space key, it crashes the game and deletes all their save data, that's a problem. And then satisfaction. And this is more important to usability than you might think, but we'll talk more about that later. So here's where things get tricky. A player's experience of a game is influenced by so many things outside of the game itself. It's influenced by the player's emotional state, how attention is regulated in their brain, their expectations of the game, the environment they're in, and of course the design of the product itself. If players were robots, usability wouldn't even be a thing. We would know exactly how the player would respond. But people, for better or for worse, are big, messy balls of conflicting impulses, and so that's what we have to deal with. And what we're talking about today is not the game, but a user's experience of the game. And it takes a while to kind of split those two things apart, but they really are different things. And an example of that is AI. When you're coding a game with AI, you don't necessarily need good AI. What you need is AI that the player thinks is good. Those are two very, very different things. You can have the most amazing AI in the world, and if the player thinks that it's stupid and predictable, then guess what? You've got a stupid and predictable AI. So we're talking about player perception, not sort of what's literally in the game itself. So we're going to start by talking about psychology, and specifically attention. And I forgot to bring this video up already. Has anybody already seen this video? Ah, curses.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to play it anyways because it's awesome.
Everyone who's seen this video, this activity, you should probably...
Shh. Oh, no. Hold on. Can you guys see this? No, you can't. I can kind of scoot it over like this. There we go. Oh no.
Oh yeah, that's your gradient, right? That's Mavericks.
Hmm?
Is this Mavericks? You have to drag it.
You have to drag this cursor goes past the screen. Yeah.
Mavericks does this
one. Oh god.
It's helping you.
Yay, usability. Alright. Let's see if I can get this to full screen. Blam. And I have no idea if we're gonna have audio. Oh, yay. Okay, let's do this.
And the player's wearing white past the basketball. How many passes did you count?
How many? You guys are smart. You go to MIT. Come on. Six teams?
The correct answer is 15 passes.
I'll give you a B+.
But did you see the gorilla?
So holy shit, there's a gorilla in the middle of the screen. And when I first saw this video as...
This video is from research by Daniel Simons.
Okay, thank you. 50% of people, including myself, do not see the gorilla when they first see that video. And that's crazy, right? There's a gorilla in the middle of the screen. So here's another example of this. This image is from a Harvard study with radiologists where they showed them slides like this one. And there's another gorilla. And they asked them to review the slides for cancer. And 83% of radiologists did not see the gorillas. So, right? 83%. So what this shows us is that what we're thinking about and what we're focused on, it's over here.
Oh.
Wow.
Well, no, it's a really important thing, is it is kind of similar color as this background area. So keep that in mind. So what we're thinking about and focused on filters our view of the world so aggressively that it very literally shapes what we see. And this is called intentional blindness. And what it means is that when people are performing an attention-demanding task, which is every game ever made, they are less likely to notice an unexpected stimulus in their field of vision. So people only see what they're looking for, which explains my big red button blunder perfectly. So here's another example of it. And a quick disclaimer, I only picked games to talk about today that I really, really like. So all of these usability critiques come out of love. So this is a game called Tiny Tycoons, great iOS game that launched for PAX East last year. And I played this game for like 2 weeks straight. I had a lot of fun with it. And one day I was kind of just putzing around and having fun and not really doing much. And I go, holy moly, there's a button that I never noticed before. I literally played this game for 2 weeks without ever noticing that info button. And so I'm playing the game again the next day, and I'm going, that is too funny. There's a massive button in the bottom of the screen that I just never noticed before. And if there's one on the right, oh my god, there's one on the left as well. So 2 weeks of playing, two gigantic buttons, quite possibly the largest buttons on the screen, and I didn't notice them. So don't make any assumptions about what your players will or will not notice. And if you'll notice, what all three of these examples have in common is that the thing that's not getting noticed is very, very similar to the background in color. So recently, if you play this game right now, you'll notice that they changed these two buttons to that blue, and that's going to help people around the world actually see them. So the problem I was having was, at no point did the tutorial draw my attention to these, and so because they're basically the same color green, my brain went, background, irrelevant, don't pay attention to it. So keep that stuff in mind. Key takeaways from this. People only pay attention to things that they think are important to the task at hand. So be really careful about having interface elements that look the same as the background. So how do we get people's attention? There are a few ways that we can kind of break through this phenomenon. You can have a stimulus process through a different sense, so a noise, or like have the iPhone vibrate. Faces, we have a specific part in our brain that is dedicated 100% to processing faces, so those jump out at us. Something that's personally relevant to the player, or a threat, and motion or blinking, and let's talk about that for a second. With great power comes great responsibility. Blinking, I'm sure you've all seen this before, when something jumps up and down on your screen, it drives you crazy. There's no way that you can't notice it. This is an iOS game called Jurassic Park, and this building is not unlocked until level 10. And I played this game on and off for a couple months, did not get to level 10. This thing sits there, and it jumps, and it bounces, and there's no way to get rid of it. You have to get to level 10, which takes God knows how long, before you can get rid of this. And it drives you crazy. Like, I don't know if any of you guys have Macs, but when the icons in the bottom of the dock bounce up and down, you're just like, for the love of God, stop doing that. This is very, very powerful. So if you're going to use this in your game, which is great because it is so powerful, you need to make sure it's something, one, really important, and two, something that players can resolve immediately. If you put this in your game and it's not, doesn't have those two criteria, the three of us are going to come find you, and we're going to look at you judgmentally until you change it. So consider yourself forewarned.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
Could you get rid of that by paying them money?
Not directly. If I indirectly found a way to level myself up to 10 and then unlock the building, probably. But there was no, like, stop this blinking by paying us a dollar, because I would have. It's driving me crazy. It's just bad design. I mean, it may have been a way for, yeah, I don't know what they were thinking. It really drove me nuts. So let's talk about emotions. Do we have any artists in the room? All right, round of applause for our one artist in the room, our one brave artist. And the reason that you deserve a round of applause is because you have been making our games easier to play. And this is for real. Attractive things are easier to use, and studies have shown this. And there's a process that explains why this is. aesthetic designs, things that look really nice, create positive attitudes in players. When you're feeling more positively, your thought processes broaden and you think a lot more creatively. So when you run into a usability problem, two things happen. One, you're just in a better mood, so you're a little bit more tolerant of the problem. But two, you're thinking more creatively, so you're going to have an easier time figuring that problem out. So what this results in, you think the game is easier to use. So be really careful about prototyping games without any kind of graphics. Like, this is a really common thing to do in the industry, but just know that people are going to perceive your game as less usable than they might when you have final graphics. On the other hand, if you really want to put yourself through a gauntlet, take all the pretty graphics out of your game and play test it. So this is a screenshot from Little Big Planet, quite possibly the cutest game on the face of the earth. This game lets players build their own levels, and it actually really relies on that user-generated content. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it has this really cutesy, beautiful, joyful, artistic style. This not only lets players be more creative, it really broadens their thinking, but it also causes players to be just a little bit more understanding when they run into those usability problems. This is another example from Girls Like Robot by local dev team Pop Cannibal. This is a game about seating arrangements. It's a deviously difficult puzzle game, and I don't know if this is on purpose or not, but I have no doubt that this really joyful, beautiful art style helps players figure out the puzzles just a little bit better. So the flip side of this is that this kind of like really beautiful, joyful art style is just not going to be appropriate for all types of games. If you're making a first-person shooter, you're probably going to go for an art style that's a little bit more in this direction. Sometimes we want to create a really high-intensity experience where the player feels a lot of stress. And what this does, instead of expanding your thought processes, is it really narrows them. And this type of tunnel vision is such, again, a very real phenomenon that the results of it have actually been codified into a couple of different laws. So if you're in an auditorium, the doors going outside have to open when you push them because there have been theater fires with pull doors, and people get to the door and they're so focused on pushing, get outside, that they're tunnel visioned on this idea of pushing and literally don't think to pull. In certain states, in hotels, the stairwell down into the basement has to be in either a different place or gated off from the stairwell up to the rest of the floors, because again, in fires, people get panicked and stressful and anxious, and they become very tunnel visioned. And what has happened is people have gone down and down and down, and they're focused on just going down, that they can go down into the basement and get trapped. So the higher stress level you're putting your player under, the more tunnel vision they're going to get. Key takeaways: if you're stressing your players out, your UI has to be really, really good. Just know the bar for you is going to be higher than for other games. On the flip side, if you want your players to think creatively, make them feel good. In studies, even a small bag of candy was enough to promote really creative thinking. So think about doing things like having beautiful graphics, or if that's just not the style that you have in your game, some sort of a small gift. Give them 20 rupees. Do whatever you need to do. Make them feel good. Here's a weird thing about emotions, is that they bleed into other things that you might not necessarily anticipate. So this text is from a 2008 study where people were given one of these two sets of written instructions on exercises. They both say the same thing, it's just the font is different. People who were shown the top set of instructions assumed, on average, that the exercise would take 8.2 minutes to complete, and they felt that it would flow quite naturally. People who were given the bottom set of instructions assumed, on average, it would take 15.1 minutes to complete, so that's nearly double, and feared that it might drag on. So given one of these two sets of instructions, people who were presented with the top set were much more willing to incorporate the exercise into their daily routine. Takeaway here, tutorial text. It has to be really easy to read, really, really, really easy. I don't care if you have a sci-fi game and you have this amazing sci-fi text that has dots and squiggles all over the place. If your player can't read it, you're doing yourself a huge disservice. So let's talk about memory. And there's a lot of different theories about how many items we can hold in our short-term memory at any given time. That's not necessarily the important thing here. What's important to know is just that it's a limited number. If you're throwing a ton of information at your player, you need to be aware that that's not all going to stick. So the more you make your player remember, the less usable your game is going to be. If your player has to memorize 23 different keyboard shortcuts or God knows how many buttons, your game is going to be less usable. So that's a trade-off that you can purposefully make. If you have a really deep game and you legitimately are going to have a lot of different controls that the player is going to need, that's fine. That can be a conscious design decision. Just know it's going to take your player a while to get there. Give them plenty of lead-up time for each new feature that you're introducing, because they're not going to learn all of these at once. It's just not going to happen. So the best strategy for dealing with information and the player is to give them what they need when they need it. Not before, not after, but at exactly the moment where they need it. And Monopoly is actually a really great example of this. So one of the rules of Monopoly is that when you pass Go, you collect $200. And this, I'm sure, is in the instructions booklet, but it's also right on the square. So as you pass Go with your little dog token, the information is literally at your fingertips. And that is fantastic information design. Another example of this is the deeds. Can you imagine playing this game if the deeds were in a booklet that you had to pass around, or if you were expected to, God forbid, memorize this information? It just wouldn't happen, right? So this information is at the fingertips of the person who needs it when they need it, and that, again, is really good information design. Or if they tried to fit this onto, like, each of the little board pieces, they tried to squeeze all that information in there, that would just be bad news bears. Visual design. So this, again, is still under the realm of psychology, but what we're really talking about here is communication. The visuals in your game, and by this I don't mean the pictures, I mean more the interface and the text, is communicating information to your player, and it's doing that regardless of whether you design it to or not, so you need to be conscious of what it is communicating, so you can do it purposefully. So the first thing it communicates is, what should I pay attention to? And this has to do with figure and ground. And the reason this is an illusion, and figure just means foreground, and ground just means background, basically. It's a fancy art term if you want to impress all your art friends. Start throwing that around. So the reason this is an illusion is because if you look at the black portion as the figure, you see a vase. And if you look at the white portion as a figure, you see two faces. So that's simple enough, right? One of the things this tells us is that areas of high contrast, so the border between these two, are what tell our visual system what is figure and what is ground. So this is a screenshot from SWTOR, and you'll see they've used this really, really nicely to pop these interface panels off of the background. So the interior of these panels is basically kind of the same hue as the rest of the background, but they've given the board this really nice glow that immediately tells the visual system, hey, this is in the foreground, you should pay attention to this. So if your user interface looks like an MC Escher painting, you're going to have a bad time. So visuals can also tell us which among a group of things is the most important. And basically it comes down to what is drawing your eye first. A really good test here is if you're looking at your game and you squint, what pulls your eye first, that's what's reading is most important. So this is all very simple stuff. Scale can tell us something is more important. Heavier text can tell us something is more important. Color can be used to draw attention. And the masters of this type of visual hierarchy are newspapers. It's really incredibly easy to tell here what's important. Oh my God, we've declared a state of war. And what's not important, this newspaper has 20 pages. So if you ever need inspiration on how to do this in your game, literally just pick up a newspaper, because they do this exceptionally, exceptionally well. So visual design also tells us what belongs together, and this comes down to grouping. So proximity, I know because they're close that this group belongs together and that group belongs together. And here's an example of proximity done wrong. This is from an iOS game called Dungeolot. What the visuals are telling me is that these 10 boxes down here all belong together. Based both off of proximity and similarity, they all look the same. These are actually four different groups of things. We have items over here, we have spells over here, this is what I have equipped to attack, and this is my mood. So that doesn't make any sense, right? these need to be separated and or visually differentiated. Similarity, which we just talked about, I know that this belongs together because they're all similar, same with that and that. And again, similarity done wrong. So this is from an iOS game called Spell Tower. These all look the same, which tells me as a player that they're all going to do the same thing. Probably that they're all going to be buttons. This is a button, this is a button. That's not a button, that's a title. And he kind of tried to get away with it by putting asterisks there. That doesn't count. That's a cheapskate way of trying to get out of this. This is not going to work. So either, ideally, this should be moved up so it's visually separated from the two buttons, and it shouldn't have the same kind of flag treatment that these do. It needs to be visually distinguished somehow. So here's symmetry, which is really interesting because it can override proximity. So if you were just going by the proximity rule, I would have four groups here. I would have one, two, three, four. But symmetry is such a powerful effect in our brain that instead we perceive this as three groups. One, two, three. And lastly, we have nesting, which are groups within larger groups to tell us what belongs together. So we understand all these things intuitively, but once you know how to articulate them, you can really start pulling things apart. So this is, I think, a Chinese website. I'm not even really sure. I don't speak Chinese or whatever language this is. Again, I'm not really sure. But I can tell you a lot about what's going on here. I can tell you that these things all belong together, that this is a title for this whole section, that these are all individual elements, and that the blue is the title and the black is probably a description. I can tell you that these all belong together because of proximity, and again, because this is bigger, it's more important, so it's probably a title and then some sort of less important description text or something down there. This is probably the highest contrast area on the screen, so this is super, super, super important. Whatever this text is, I assume it's the title for that. They really want you to buy the glowy thing. I don't know what it is, but they're pushing that hard right now. So I don't speak this language, but because of the visual design of the web page, you can pull a lot of information out of it. So when you're designing anything that has text for your players, just be aware of what you're communicating to them by the visual structure. So this is a screenshot from a game that I worked on for a couple years called Robot Rising. It was a Facebook game that was basically like Diablo, but with robots and on Facebook. And all of these visual strategies were used to communicate what's going on in this interface really effectively. So this is your health, which is probably the most important thing when you're in a battle. So this is a really high contrast area. These are sort of visually similar, so that communicates to the player that there's some similarity there, but there's a nice little gap in the middle, and the visual treatment is different. These are all black and orange, and these are all fully colored, so that tells you that these are really two different things, and these are your items, and these are your special attacks. Proximity tells us that those things all belong together, and those are your resources, and those things all belong together, and those are your things that aren't resources. I don't know, what are they? Oh, they're currency and you're leveling and stuff like that. So that all belongs together. These really aren't very important over here. They're tiny little icons. That's things like going full screen, adjusting the volume. So this is an example of a lot of these visual strategies really done well to communicate. So one question that pops up a lot when you're talking about visual design is, do you go with icons or do you go with text? And the question boils down to, do you just use text? Do you use text and an icon? Or do you just use an icon? And the problem is that when you have a new player, icons alone can be very confusing, but as soon as the player learns what that icon means, that makes a much less cluttered interface, and that actually works much better. And that's called the, I can never really pronounce this, pictorial superiority effect, or PSE, which states that the more visual the input becomes, the more likely it is to be recognized and recalled. IKEA instructions are so goddamn good at this. If you ever need inspiration on how to communicate something visually, just pull out as many sets of IKEA instructions as you can. I love this guy who's like, oh my god, I don't know what I'm doing, so I'm going to call IKEA because they have flags. I really think that they didn't know how to draw this in perspective, so they were like, whatever, we're just going to throw some flags on there. Anyways, So visuals are processed 60,000 times faster than text. So if you can use icons, do use icons. Pairing visuals with text also increases the memory retention by a factor of 6. So this is a very powerful effect. However, icons and visuals only work better if they're done really well. So this is the new Game Center icon for iOS 7. There's nothing about that that says anything about games. Like, the old icon was spectacularly ugly, but at least it read as something to do with games. This has to do with bubbles and colors and paint, maybe? I don't know. So as soon as you learn what this icon means, it works just fine. But for anybody that is less technically apt, that's really coming into the operating system blind, they're not going to have any idea what this icon means. So use icons, but only if you can do it really well. So how do you make the best of visuals? You have to keep your graphics visually simple and clean. The more cluttered your icons look, the longer it's going to take somebody to process them. Icons have to have enough visual variety so they can be distinguished at a glance really quickly. So if you have 17 different icons that all have some sort of envelope on them, that's going to start getting very confusing to your players very fast. Consistency is super important. If your save icon changes place on every different screen on your game, you're confusing the heck out of your players. And lastly, visuals need to be immediately recognizable to a large portion of the population. So something like this, we all know at this point that that means trash can or delete. Something like this is maybe a little bit less clear. So this is where playtesting is really, really valuable. All of this is where playtesting is really valuable, this in particular. So let's talk a little bit about physical input. Human beings are input-output devices that interface with the inputs of a game. So if your game has a touchscreen versus controller buttons versus keyboard and mouse, that's going to have a huge impact on what's going to be usable in that game and what's not. So this is one of my favorite laws. It's called Fitt's Law. And it's talking specifically when you're working with a mouse on a computer screen. And what it says is the time to acquire a target, so the time to click on something, is a function of the distance to that target and the size of the target. So if that's my mouse over there, and I'm trying to click on one of these two things, that's going to be faster because it's bigger. The same way, if I'm trying to click on one of these two things, that's going to be faster because it's closer. Nice and straightforward, right? So here's the really important question. If you have your mouse in the exact middle of a screen, and you have to place a single pixel target somewhere on the screen, can you guys tell me the 5 fastest places for the player to click on? Yeah. Yes. You guys are either really smart or somebody has asked you this before. So, that's exactly right. And the reason for this, the one that your mouse is already on is obvious, because you literally don't have to move. It's right there. And the reason for the 5 corners of the screen is because the edges of the screen have effectively an infinite target size. If I'm trying to click on this, I have to modulate my mouse speed as I get over there, and so that's going to slow me down pretty effectively. If I'm trying to click on this, I can just like whoosh, whack my mouse into the corner of the screen and it's going to catch it, because it doesn't matter if I hit here or if I hit over here, the screen ends here, so I'm going to land there. So this is infinitely large in one direction, and the corners are all infinitely large in 2 directions. So those are very, very easy for the players to click on. So keep in mind, if you have a screen and you put your buttons here, you need to make sure that the player can click here on the edge of the screen to click on that button, because otherwise you're losing out on all the benefits of this effect. So put your buttons on the edge, but make sure the player really can click on the edge. So as an example of this, and I couldn't find a screenshot of it, but again, from SPOTOR, as you gather from resource nodes, the confirmation dialog pops up right under your mouse, and it's beautiful, and I love it every time it happens, and it just saves me a lot of mousing around. So, good idea. So I've talked at you about a ton of different elements of usability today. It's a really complicated topic. It's something that changes changes out from under your feet constantly as you're dealing with different types of players. You can switch something small in your game and it can have a huge effect. You can spend 5 weeks changing a huge thing in your game and it can have a small or negligent effect. So the question is, where do we go from here? Because usability is really hard, and there are so many things we didn't talk about, including conceptual models, environments, affordances, error handling. I could make a very, very long list here. And as designers, we have a real conundrum, because there is so much that we know about our game. We know more about our game than literally anybody else on the planet. We know how it works. We know what every button does. If we need information in the game, we know exactly where to go for it. But we are the least qualified people on the planet to know these things, to know how the player expects the game to work based on what they're seeing, to know how much the player remembers after they've played through your game once, because you've played through your game how many thousands of times at this point? You know everything. You've got it down pat. Like, yay you. So you can't really figure out what's going on in somebody else's brain. And you don't necessarily know what types of errors the player is going to make, because you've already made those errors, or you're not making any errors, because again, you know how your game works. So when you're playing it, why would you make those errors? And the answer is playtesting. This is like my mantra for life. Playtest early, playtest often. Playtesting is painful. You're going to sit there and your player is going to screw up your game and you're going to be like, for the love of God, why is this happening? This is horrible. And you're going to want to tell them all the things you're doing wrong, and you can't, because that ruins the playtest. Playtesting is one of the hardest things you can do as a designer. It's also one of the most valuable. So that, do that. Ideally, when you're designing a game, you want to playtest with a couple of people every couple of weeks. When you get any further than that, you've made so many changes that it's hard to tell what playtesting outcomes are correlated to what changes you've made. So playtest as frequently as you can, and make sure you're doing tissue testing, which means that you get new people in who have never seen the game. So it's like you use a tissue and you throw it out. That's where the name comes from. So don't just playtest with the same people, because they already know what's going on in your game. Make sure you're bringing in new people. So thank you for letting me come in and chat with you for a little bit. I'm going to stick around for a little bit longer, so I'm happy to take any questions now or later. Also, please feel free to email me or tweet at me. I'm not very good at Twitter, but I try. And yeah, so any questions? I'll take a drink. Yeah?
So at the beginning, you mentioned satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you didn't really talk about it specifically.
So satisfaction relates back to the visuals. The enjoyment that a player gets from a game is going to help make that game more usable. So that has to do with visuals. It can also have to do with a lot more subtle stuff. One of the big things you try to do in level design, for example, is just try to make the level fun to run around, even without any enemies in it. So that can put the player in a better mood. I don't know if any of you guys have played Farmville 2. I worked on Facebook games for a while, so I had to play like every Facebook game ever. And just moving your mouse around in that game is awesome, because everything reacts. Like, you move your mouse over a little cow, and it's like, woo-hoo! Like, it just, it's great. I would just sit there and kind of like trail my mouse around. So little things like that can really have a positive effect on the player, which has a positive effect on the usability.
Yeah. So Chris law only applies if your game goes full screen, right? So if it's in
yes.
the window or something?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Or if the mouse is caught on the edge of the window.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What is Little Worlds Interactive?
Ah, excellent question. I'm not very good at self-promotion, so thanks for asking. And I'm going to pull up a website. Oh, crap. So this is the company that I recently founded, and that's not going to work. Aha, there we go. So I am developing an educational game for kids called The Counting Kingdom. And is it okay if I show a short term?
Yeah, please.
Thank you. So that's what I've been working on. We're looking at sort of a, all right, I give up on making this work, on like an early next year release-ish. I'm trying to make educational games that aren't, crap, there are so many games in the App Store right now that are glorified quizzes, and I think we can do so much better than that. I don't know about you guys, but I grew up with Oregon Trail and with Adventure Mountain, and those were fun. Those were legitimately fun, and I felt like I was going on an adventure, and games now are just, they feel very sugar-coated and dumbed down, so I'm trying to create something that legitimately has some strategy, but that also incorporates math skills to get the player to the end of the level. So that's what I'm working on.
So that's being open for touchscreen.
iOS. Yep. I'm hoping I'm going to look at possibly doing a PC release and possibly doing a browser demo. So I'm trying to keep that in mind as I build it. But right now, touchscreen. Yep.
So there's probably some one-on-one student here who's interested in doing app development for a smartphone or a tablet or something like that. Are there any like usability things that you picked up along the way regarding designing for a touchscreen that are like maybe are very different when it comes to designing for a mouse?
That's a really good question. Yes.
So I worked at an iOS app shop several years ago.
Like, what was it?
Sorry.
What was it?
It was called Intrepid Pursuits. It's just like in Cambridge up here.
Oh yeah, I grew up there all the time.
Yeah, and so like one thing that was like a usability issue was we had like an app that was like a book that you needed to flip the pages for, but swipes that came from off screen were not detected, so you had to like parse those differently. So like a lot of like little technical issues of like how the gestures are passed between views is like really frustrating.
Yeah, and building on that, players think that they're being a lot more precise on touchscreens than they actually are. So I went to a great dev talk a year or two ago. You guys by Jack Lumber? Yeah, so it's by a local team called Alchemy, and basically a tree falls over and kills your granny, and so you commit to take revenge on the forest. So every level you get these boards of lumber that are tossed up, and you basically have to pause time by touching the screen and then drag your finger through the boards to split them. So that's kind of the gist of the game. The problem is that if you lift your finger, then time starts again and the boards fly across the screen and you probably are going to lose the level. So what they were finding was anytime there was something near the bottom of the screen, players would go just so slightly off the bottom of the screen and think that they were still on, but the system was reading them as off, and so they were failing the level. So this is, again, one of those areas where the player's perception is that they're getting screwed over by the game because they're like, what the heck? I was on the screen. Why are you making me lose the level? So when the player blames the game for something, that's when you have a usability problem. So what they did was if you went off the screen, you had a pixel distance and a timer. And if you came back on the screen within the parameters for both of those things, it basically told the game that you stayed on to say, they were close enough, they stayed on, we're gonna let them have it. So precision is definitely an issue. Things like 3D on touchscreens are really hard. Trying to get players to navigate around in 3D is just a painful experience. Generally, I don't know if I've seen a game that really does that right. Generally, any time that you're taking a game and you're translating it from one set of inputs to another set of inputs, something somewhere is not gonna work right. It's like when you're trying to develop a game for consoles and then you put it on the PC, you really have to translate what's happening. So that's kind of the biggest problem I've seen is when people go in and just be like, oh, we'll just throw it on a touchscreen, it'll work fine, without really thinking through what the limitations are of a touchscreen and what the advantages are of a touchscreen. All right, cool. Well, I'll stick around for a little bit. So just come up and say hi if you have any questions.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. So take about 5 minutes to get organized in your teams. What we're going to do are short presentations. So how many teams do we have? Three? So we kind of turn into? All right. So each team gets about 5 minutes to come up, display your product backlog if you can, and just give a brief overview of what you've done for the past 2 weeks, what the state of your backlog is, what your next sprint is going to be, what you're going to be doing in your next sprint. We'll start that at 2 p.m.
Content from the following sources is copyright of the respective holders, all rights reserved, excluded from our Creative Commons license. For more information, see ocw.mit.edu/fairuse. Simons, Daniel. Selective Attention Test. March 10th, 2010. YouTube video. Little Worlds Interactive. The Counting Kingdom trailer for Boston Festival of Indie Games 2013. September 10th, 2013. YouTube video.